Welcome to the first episode of The Audacity with Jim Suhan. I am Jim Suhan. I'm here with my longtime producer, Brandon Morton. This is TalkNorth.com. Why am I doing another show? I think I'm already on six other shows on this network. I have plenty of other things to do. I have a guitar fetish. I have a golf addiction. I have dogs. I have a wife. I have a busy A job. Why am I doing another show? Well, as we built out TalkNorth.com and brought on so many great people, so many great personalities, I wanted to play the role of point guard. I wanted to pass the ball to really talented people. I wanted to set up really talented people. I wanted to hear what they had to say. And that's worked great. And it's been a blast. Having people like Cheryl Reeve and Michael Russo and Roy Smalley on this network has been just, it's been one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my life or my career. But I kind of miss just having the vocal, audible outlet where I can just straight ahead tell you what I think and get into all kinds of different topics in one show. That's what this show will be. So this show is generally going to be divided into two segments. The first will be 6 points. That will be six different segments on six different looks at the sports world from six different angles. And then the second half of the show will generally be an interview. This week's is Derek Falvey, and that segment will be called 10 Minutes with Someone I Don't Hate. So I appreciate Derek Falvey being our first guest here. So Brandon, this should be fun. And I guess that's the point here is I have other outlets. I have other places I can say what I want. I can have other outlets where I can write what I want. I really want the show to be, I can't help but be blunt. That's in my nature. It's in my job description. But I also want to have fun with this. I think there are so many fun little aspects of the sports world that we can get into here on this show. And I tell you what, my two favorite talk shows of all time, my favorite two sports talk shows of all time were done by Tony Kornheiser and Dan Le Batard. And what they had in common was, yes, they would get to the issues of the day, but they would also find that great, funny little angle and they'd go with it. You know, they wouldn't feel like they have to spend half an hour breaking down the throwing mechanics of Carson Wentz. You know, they found something fun to talk about within the sports world. And Brandon, you're here to help me get to those stories.
Yes, I'm the layperson in all of this mess. No, it's, you know, the cool thing about you getting this opportunity too, Jim, to get your point out across bluntly in this podcast world is it's podcasting. It's completely different than the world of print. It's more of that free thought, free flow going. So I'm excited that you're doing this, and I'm excited to be on board to, I don't know if keep you in line would be the correct term, but
I think that's correct. Keep me in line, keep me on the rails, something like that. Brandon was the first person who joined me on this network however many years ago. He's been with us all. He's kept this thing afloat. He's overworked and underpaid. I admit that. So this is also a chance for Brandon to get on the air and have some fun with us. And I do appreciate everything Brandon has done for this network.
Well, now that we've gotten all these introductions out of the way, yes, Jim, let's just get right down to it. And what's getting on your nerves this week?
The first of our 6 points, what is on my nerve? Okay, so Major League Baseball has made the decision, per my suggestion on Twitter a week ago, to pull the All-Star game from Atlanta. And this is creating the predictable backlash, which is, this is cancel culture. How can you mix sports and politics like this? This is not cancel culture. This is consequence culture. Businesses have the right to align themselves with businesses, like in sports. Sports is a business. This is not fun and games. Sports is a business. We all know that. That's why these franchises are worth billions of dollars. They built this into a massive business. It's also a very visible business, and it's a business that employs a lot of people of color. This is not anyone canceling. This is businesses deciding they don't want to be associated with the state of Georgia as the state of Georgia suppresses minority voting. Why would any business want to be associated with that? Unless your business is the Ku Klux Klan, and then maybe this is right on brand for you. The idea of cancel culture is silly. Tell you what, we, Brandon, will probably at some point in this network's history have an advertiser leave us because they don't like something they hear on one of the shows. That's not them canceling us. That's them exercising their freedom of choice to put their money with people they believe in. And you know what? I will completely accept it when it happens to us.
Well, it's just as you said. That's a consequence, and you can't separate politics and sports. They're intertwined. That's just the way it works. And like you said, sports is a business. If people choose to give their money to you to support their business, they can choose not to as well.
That is exactly right. And I'm actually really proud of Major League Baseball, because baseball is not the most progressive sport. It just isn't. They've done a poor job of finding and developing young black players. The number of black players in Major League Baseball has dipped. They have not always been very aware of the surroundings. And like a lot of major businesses, they would rather not get into this realm. They would rather not deal with any of this. I get that. It's not fun. And at any time they make a public decision like this, anytime they make a public statement that has anything to do with race or politics, they are going to lose some people. That is the way it works. So I actually appreciate Rob Manfred and Major League Baseball having the guts to do this, because, you know, hey, there are consequences for good decisions too. They will lose some money someplace along this. They will tick off a business owner or a major business that doesn't want to be involved in this kind of decision making. So I admire what they're doing here. That is my last nerve, though, is the phrase cancel culture, because it's usually employed by people who would absolutely cancel you if they disagreed with you.
Well, the term cancel culture is just a latest buzzword to get people upset about something they have no need to be upset about.
That is correct.
You make a mistake, you pay for your mistake. Baseball's doing right, in my opinion, by making this change. But anyways, Jim, so, okay, that gets on your nerve. I understand that. It gets on my nerve, too. What made you happy over the past week?
All right. Second of 6 points. I've spent much of my professional life covering baseball, and it was a goal of mine growing up. I covered high school sports for a long time, and in Texas, that meant mostly football. I covered the NFL for 4 years, both in Dallas and Minnesota. I finally got a chance to cover the Minnesota Twins here. And since I started covering the Twins in 93, baseball has probably taken up more time than anything else in my professional career. And listen, baseball has its flaws. The games are too long. The season's too long. It can drive you crazy. If the team is bad, nobody wants to watch, you know, however many hours of baseball that is, if the team has no chance. Luckily, the Twins are now competitive. And I can't tell you, both going to spring training and just seeing baseball on the field in person, and then coming home and watching the opener Milwaukee on my TV, regardless of the result, column 8, throw the ball to first base. Despite the frustrating things that happened in that game, it reminded me what I love about baseball. And what I love about baseball is not sitting there and overanalyzing every pitch, although you can do that. And sometimes when I'm covering a game, I might do that. What I love about baseball is you don't have to pay close attention to it. And it reminded me when I was living in Arlington, Texas. We lived in this cheap little apartment. I was broke. I think I was making $10 an hour with no benefits. Living in this cheap little apartment in Arlington, Texas, but it was walking distance to Arlington Stadium, the so-called Major League Stadium of the Texas Rangers. And I would get my kids to bed like 9 o'clock or something, and I would walk across the street and go watch the last few innings for free, because I couldn't afford tickets at that point, and sit in the outfield. And the temperature just about then for most July nights was just ticking down from 100 to 99. It was cool to see that on the scoreboard. But what I loved is I could bear down on every pitch, or I could bring a book, or I could listen to music, you know. And I love having baseball on in my home. It's one of my favorite things. And I feel so badly for people who don't have access to the TV broadcast. Now, I love baseball on radio too, but listen, we're all pretty visual in this day and age. And the fact that Bally Sports, Fox Sports North, the owners of Bally Sports, Sinclair, have put up this fight that has kept baseball fans from being able to watch their sport, it makes me crazy. But of course, that would be more of a last nerve topic. My positive thing here is that baseball's back. It's on my TV, and I get to watch. It's like, to me, the best mass form of entertainment there is.
It's the true sign of summer. As soon as baseball season rolls around, I'm instantly happy just to know I can actually do something outside and enjoy the weather. And a baseball game is part of that. Just being able to sit outside in Twin Stadium, limited capacity this year, is definitely going to be one of my goals.
A reminder, if you'd like to advertise with this show or anywhere on the network, you can reach former Twins executive Karen Cleary at KCLEARY at talknorth.com. We are just starting out this show. We haven't even started trying to line up advertisers. We wanted to get the show rolling first. But of course, we make our living on advertising, so we appreciate any referrals or anybody can help us in that way. I don't have to thank Brandon because I've already thanked him. You can find all the shows at TalkNorth.com. You can follow us on Twitter at TalkNorthPod. See the shows that are released. And again, we have Cheryl Reeve, Roy Smalley, Michael Russo, Anthony LaPanta, John Millay, John Krasinski, tons of outdoor stuff, Bar Down Beauties, Gopher Hole. And we're going to be adding a couple really cool names here in the next month or two, including one you'll be hearing from next week. Again, thank you to everyone who has listened to the network and helped us get to this point. It's been really cool to help to build this thing out and work with more and more collaborators as we've done so. All right, next point.
Sports aside, let's talk about the real world for a little bit.
So I really admire, you know, and you at the beginning of the show, you heard the opening music clip was produced by the bass player in my band, the Bar Chords, Matt Gillimer. He's a really talented guy, great bass player, and he puts together some bumper music for us. We're also, my band might also produce some more as we go forward here. And, you know, I play in a band. I love music. I love singer-songwriters. Jason Isbell is coming to the Armory in Minnesota December 1st. And I love Jason Isbell. I love his band. He's a great guitarist. He has a great band behind him. Great songwriter, great artist. And he's one of those people, like when he comes to my town, I feel like I should support him and I'm not going to go. And it's because I don't know after the pandemic. I mean, I can't wait for normalcy. I can't wait for crowds in stadiums. I can't wait to walk around downtown Minneapolis again. I want normalcy back. I can't wait to get out of the house and do all these things. What I don't know is if I'm ever going to go to a concert where it's general admission and you're kind of just standing around and people are walking by and coughing in your face and bumping up against you. I don't know if I can do it. And the only seats I could get right now to Jason Isbell would be standing on the floor where anybody can walk up to you before they want. And what all this has made me realize in this entire COVID protocol year is that of all the things I miss, I don't miss being crowded. I don't miss having somebody lean up against me, cough on me. I just don't miss that at all. I don't know if I'll ever go to that kind of a music show again. And I hate to say that because First Avenue is that way, the Armory is that way. So I might be missing out on some great shows.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do in general is to go to concerts, go to different venues, go to different states, cities, anything like that to catch a good show. And part of that is being scrunched up against the front row, being smashed up, you know, with the force of the crowd behind you. And I agree with you. I don't know if I'll ever be comfortable with that. Maybe someday, years down the road. But as for the foreseeable future, even a concert indoors, even if you have separated seating, still a little bit uncomfortable to me. I'm getting my vaccine today, but I can't guarantee everybody else out there is going to. And by the sounds of it, not everybody's going to either. So I'm with you. I think that's going to be one of those weird, weird things of getting back to quote unquote reality, is accepting the things that you no longer can or should do. And unfortunately, live music might be one of those.
And you bring up another aside before we get to media sometimes matters, which is the fourth of our 6 points today. You know, I keep on running into people who think that the government is planting a locating device in your shoulder when you get the vaccine.
It's already in your pocket.
Well, there are a couple things here. First of all, they don't need to put a chip in your pocket. If you have a phone, people know where you are. If you have credit cards, people know where you are. If you have a car that was bought after 1971, people know where you are. The other thing is, there are 330 Americans. I know people who work in the intelligence services. Nobody wants to track 330 Americans. They only want to track like the, you know, 5 million crazies Americans. Nobody wants to track the average American. They don't have the time or the manpower or the patience to do it. But this kind of goes also to the old argument, the government wants to take my guns. Here's how you know the government doesn't want your guns, Brandon. If the government wanted your guns, the government would have your guns. Okay, the government has an army, a navy, an air force, marines, SEALs, black ops operators, CIA, NSA, FBI, local law enforcement, Constable Bob and the other, I mean, if they wanted to take your guns, they would simply come and take your guns. So the evidence that they don't want your guns is that you still have your guns.
Yeah, it's just a political ploy to get you to vote for one side or the other. If they wanted something to be illegal or banned, it would have been done by now. There's a reason why it's not, and that's to keep you voting for a certain party that wants to, quote unquote, make it illegal or legal. So, yeah, I agree. So, you know, the media does matter sometimes, not always to some of these people that we might have been speaking of earlier, but the media does matter sometimes.
Point four, media sometimes matters. Listen, I'm not going to be all self-referential about the media. I'm not going to defend the media. There are lots of things in the media that drive me crazy, including in local sports coverage. This is an incredibly soft, butt-kissing market in a lot of ways. And it's kind of my job as a sports columnist at your local newspaper to offset that sometimes. But let me tell you today why media sometimes matters. The Twins blow a lead on Thursday in Milwaukee. The closer blows it. He throws to the wrong base. Kepler almost makes a great play, barely misses. That ends up being very costly. Andrelton Simmons, one of the greatest fielders in the game, drops a throw. Josh Donaldson gets hurt. Luis Arraez has to play third base and misplays a ball. Kenta Maeda comes out after 4 1/3 inning. There are all these stories that would be fascinating to tell. And if we were working the clubhouse the way we usually do in good times, we would have had a chance to ask questions of all these people. And they would have had a chance to explain themselves, to tell us what was going on, to tell their story. And even if it's not a good story, you know, listen, sports is just as much about losing as it is about winning and how you handle losing. I can't tell you how much goodwill and how much respect was earned by so many people I covered in that Twins clubhouse over the years, like Rick Aguilera, Eddie Guardado, Joe Nathan. If they blew a save, they would come out and they would stand at their locker and they would take every question, not because that was pleasant for them, but because they were professionals and they realized that was part of the job. They also realized if you want your version of the story out, you should tell your version of the story directly, not let people speculate. And to have three, I think we had three writers in Milwaukee, and none of them got to ask any questions of these players. And that's not a good thing. And I know there are people in this country who hate the media and think we should be restricted from everything. You want good, responsible journalists working stories. That is the way democracy works. That's the way sports journalism works. And it was really jarring to pick up the paper the next day and have all these questions in my mind and not see any of them answered because we can't get in the clubhouse.
It's as simple as this. Without the media, there's no intrigue. There's no reason to want to watch these sports beyond numbers. And people like the sports because of the stories. They like the personalities. Lou Ford wasn't the greatest Twins player or player about that. But if it weren't for just even the media and the stories, we wouldn't all kind of have this little bit of love for Lou Ford for no other reason than the media bringing out his personality. So people that complain about it, they really do like the media in that sort of sense because, again, we like this. We like to follow the stories. We like the personalities. And without you guys being there asking those questions, we would have no insight to it. And it would just be a numbers game and that would get boring.
Yeah. Baseball is about personalities and storytelling and big moments and what happened before. But what if we didn't know that Kirby Puckett said, jump on my back, you know, before game six of the World Series? I mean, do we not want to know that he said that? Do we not want to hear stories of, you know, I mean, that story has been told and retold by, you know, dozens of Twins employees over the last, you know, however many years. Do we not want to know that? Well, the way you get to know that is by going in and talking to people and getting those stories. And sometimes we get them and we write them on deadline before, you know, anybody else in the world even knows that's happening. So listen, I will very often criticize national and local media in this segment, but you want people in the clubhouse. And if baseball tries to restrict that or sports try to restrict that, the sports world will be poorer for it.
We wouldn't have Wade Boggs drinking beer stories.
That's right.
Simple as that. We wouldn't have those legendary stories. Media there. All right. I guess moving on, here comes our fifth section. What can we look forward to this upcoming week, Jim?
Well, you mentioned, you know, the spring training in baseball kind of signaled the beginning of spring. I've been very lucky to get to cover the Masters frequently for the Star Tribune. I'm going down there again on Monday to cover. I'll be doing a couple of shows from down there as well. And this is the beginning of spring for me. And I know I'm privileged, and I apologize to those who don't get to do this kind of stuff. But going, my two favorite assignments of the year, people would think it might be Super Bowl or, you know, NCAA Final Four and all that. My two favorite assignments of all time are going to spring training because of the conversations you get to have down there and the relaxed nature of spring training and getting to see baseball in person, and the Masters. And I'm really glad the Masters kind of cleaned themselves up in a lot of ways. You know, they actually now, you know, they have a diverse membership. You know, they have come a long way in terms of growing up as an organization. But I tell you what, the golf itself, to leave Minnesota during this kind of sludgy period and go down to Augusta, Georgia, and get to walk around on that golf course in beautiful weather, see the greatest golfers in the world play. And I'm not going to say anything that hasn't been said before. Golf is a very well-covered, well-thought-about sport. But the great thing about the Masters is not only is it beautiful, not only does it come across on camera as gorgeous, but we see Tiger Woods playing the same shot into 13 that Jack Nicklaus did, that Ben Hogan did, that Bobby Jones did. And yeah, different distance, different clubs, whatever. But the challenges are the same. And there's history behind every shot. So you combine the beauty, the fact that it's the first major, it's the only major that is played in the same location every year. Every shot has these layers of meaning. And I love that. I mean, to me, it's the best thing to write about because you have atmosphere, you have knowledgeable fans. By the way, this is also the only place where I'm glad fans, the only golf tournament where I'm really glad fans are returning. Because let's be honest, every golf crowd at every other venue is ruined by mashed potatoes guy, you know, by get in the hole guy. Yeah. They don't let you do that at the Masters. And I am all for their rules and their enforcement of those rules because they don't have an idiot standing on the first tee yelling mashed potatoes. You know, there is actually some decorum, and it just adds to the mystique of the entire place.
Here's my callback to the previous one. See, that this is why the media matters, but you just painted a story of the Masters and made me kind of want to watch it. And, well, I'm just jealous that you get to walk the course and be a part of the whole ambiance. It's such a legendary event.
It's great. And it's also one of those places you wouldn't, and again, I wouldn't know this if I hadn't covered it. As gorgeous as it looks on camera, what you don't get on camera is the elevation changes are dramatic. From the top of the 10th, from the 10th tee down to the 13th green, it's like a ski slope. It doesn't look that way on TV. It looks gradual on TV. The 10th fairway is a ski slope. The 11th fairway is a little gentler, but still goes dramatically downhill. The second shot on 11 is straight downhill, and it's gorgeous, but it's also very difficult. And you know, you're talking about like on 10, straight downhill, you have guys downhill lie. In other words, you know, if you're not really a golfer, your body's aligned, so your right foot is higher than your left foot for a right-handed golfer, and you have to hit the ball up in the air to a slick green that is angled toward you. If you haven't played golf, it's hard to describe how hard that shot is. So it's beautiful, but it's treacherous. And here's the other thing about the Masters, and they got away from this for a little while, and they finally righted themselves. So many golf majors set themselves up just to be hard. And in making themselves as hard as possible, they take away the thrill of the eagle, the thrill of the, you know, the difficult birdie. They turn golfers into conservative robots, and it's not very entertaining. It's a test of survival instead of a flamboyant test of athletic ability. The Masters allows you risk-reward shots, 13, 15, you know, two. You can go for it. And if you pull it off, it might win you the tournament. And if you miss, it might lose you the tournament. And that's another great thing about the Masters is it's a fun course. It's a fun course to watch a tournament on. And some golf tournaments forget that this is supposed to be fun.
Wait, golf a game is supposed to be fun? I don't understand this.
Well, unless you play and then you just hate the game and hate yourself.
See, that's what I thought it was. I always relate golf to self-loathing and me wanting to hit things, but that's
it's that too.
Okay. Well, we're going to wrap it up onto the final subject. This one's going to be weird for me to introduce, so why don't you introduce it, Jim?
Segment number six, the sixth point is don't take it from me. And I actually feel weird saying this because going into the off season, I thought the Vikings, they had a very mediocre year last year. They kind of salvaged some respect, but they did not win any games they really needed to win. They kind of just righted themselves enough to be average. And they came into this off season with no cap space, difficult decisions to make, having to rebuild an entire defense. And I didn't know how they were going to do it. And I really was doubtful they were going to be able to do it. They have, despite their cap limitations, they have rebuilt their defense. And they need Danielle Hunter to come back and play great. But they're also, Tomlinson's a very good player. Pierce is a very good player who should be coming back. They ended up, they ended up losing Anthony Harris, but bringing in another safety who should be at least about as good. This is a good defense again. Now, they still have some young players, but every NFL team has it. It's a salary cap league. Everybody has flaws. Everybody needs some young players to come along. But now you can look at the cornerback situation and say, that could work out. You can look at the safety and say, that could work out. You look at the linebacker and say, if they're healthy, they're more than good enough. Defensive line, if Hunter comes back and plays well, they're more than good enough. And the one obvious flaw they have, letting Riley Reiff go, could be fixed in the first round of the draft. And if they do that, it doesn't mean that they're magically going to be a great team next year, but they would be pretty well positioned for the next few years in a division where two of the teams have no idea what they're doing, and the Green Bay Packers seem to be intent on ticking off their franchise player. So, in other words, my level of optimism for the Vikings franchise has been altered by the last couple of months, and that usually doesn't happen.
How long will this positivity last, though?
Until they blow a lead in week one.
Okay, well, that's fair enough.
Actually, the fascinating thing about the Vikings and why they're such a great team to cover is they're never bad. They're never out of it. They're never hopeless. Now, have they ever finished it off and won a world championship? No, but I don't really judge franchises on just championships. It's too simplistic for me. There's so many other. This is supposed to be entertainment. And the Vikings are entertaining. Their games matter. They play meaningful game after meaningful game. They win some of them. They have good years and bad years. But, the biggest of big pictures here is the Vikings continue to be a fascinating team to watch and to write about. I love that.
To me, they just sound kind of like a drug where they give you just enough to keep you hooked.
That would be on point.
But they keep you going just enough to give you some hope and happiness. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like you're making a pitch to a sponsor right here.
Yeah. Maybe I am. Reaching out on that first episode.
All right, so we'll be back next week. I have a guest I hope you'll enjoy next week. This week's guest for 10 or more minutes with someone I don't hate is Twins boss Derek Falvey. And what I'm going to try to do with these interviews, I'm going to try to get away from the day-to-day winning and losing of games and get to know people, let you see a side of them you might not see in other interviews, and generally have some fun. And Derek Falvey was the perfect first guest for that. And welcome to our weekly interview segment that is titled, at least for now, 10 or more minutes with someone I don't hate. Today's guest and the first guest on the Audacity is Derek Falvey. He is the Twins baseball boss. I know his title's much longer than that, but it was a short show, so we're not going to read it all off. Kind of like Phil Mickelson telling Tiger Woods to stop having all of his titles introduced. It would take too long. Derek, my first question for you today is, I grew up as a typical little kid baseball geek. I went to games. I collected baseball cards. I got autographs. And you were a baseball player, but you also obviously have a great interest in the analytics side of the game. Were you a typical little baseball geek growing up, or were you the guy who was going to go play computer baseball as well?
No, I was the prototype you just described. I was the as many baseball cards as I could get. I'd order them. I'd make teams. I'd put them in alphabetical order. I'd put them in team order. My dad said he's found recently found some boxes of them that are still in some unique orders somewhere packed away in the basement. So I was your typical go-to, couldn't get enough of it type of baseball geek, quite frankly.
Who did you idolize?
Oh, man. I grew up in the Boston area, so the New England area, and this was back when some of those Red Sox teams they weren't the best of their more, I guess, more recent runs, you know, pre-World Series championships. But I remember in the early 90s, growing up, I wanted to be a catcher, right? So Tony Pena was a guy, and I even tried to kick my leg out and caught like him from time to time. I was never flexible. I've never been flexible, and that didn't look so good then. But I remember Tony Pena being one of those types of players I really liked watching.
It's so funny you say that, because when you're a kid, the guy who does something a little differently can really attract the eye. I mean, I remember, you know, in my era growing up watching Joe Morgan, the fact that he just flapped his right arm before he hit fascinated me.
You're exactly right. I mean, I think you get drawn to different kinds of players. Obviously, you know, during those years, Roger Clemens was a great pitcher on those Red Sox teams. There were a number of other guys that were really good and ultimately, you know, were good over the course of their career. But Tony had that unique leg out position. I kind of liked catching at the time. You know, it was just one of those, as you said, it draws you to it. And it's one of the unique charms of the game still that I enjoy today.
I remember I was on a baseball trip once, and I was able to secure a seat at Fenway for a friend of mine and from the Boston area, you know, through a bunch of back channels. And I paid for the ticket, but I did have connections that probably weren't available to the average human. And this person told me that they'd been trying to get Red Sox tickets for like 30 years, and that was the first time they ever actually got to see a game at Fenway. Did you get to watch games at Fenway Park?
Yeah, so not very often. You know, I grew up about 10 minutes outside the city in a really, you know, blue collar city. We didn't get a chance, you know, to go to Red Sox games all that often. Maybe could get to afford one maybe a year, but we would, and we would try and get to one of them. It was definitely about as far away in the grandstand or the bleachers as you could sit, but it was still getting a chance to go to Fenway Park, and you know that's what breeds your love for the game. But I would go once a year, and then I would watch and listen just about every other day I could, for sure.
Yeah, so I remember one of my strongest memories of being on the beat in the 90s was sitting in the dugout before a Twins Red Sox game in Fenway. And Tom Kelly, and you know, Tom had a reputation for being gruff, being tough on 90% of media people, on, you know, being short, curt, whatever the phrase you want to use. But he also could be very eloquent, and he loved the game, and he got him in the right mood, and he would just be this, you know, he would almost be a novella. You know, he would tell you a story. And I remember sitting in the dugout with him before a game at Fenway. It was twilight, you know, the light was failing, and it was just like the Jump John Updike scene setting. You know, there were like 18 different shades of green. And I just remember Tom sitting there and just going, beautiful night at Fenway Park. You won't see this much green anywhere. So I didn't have a question. I just wondered if Fenway had that hold on you as well.
You know, it did in a different way, though. When I was a kid, I would, like I just said, I would go maybe once a year, you know, or if someone, you know, you found a way to get tickets through somebody else along the way, it would be great. But you that's what you grew up with. As I started to work in the game and I went to Cleveland and I'd been there for a number of years and then went back, you start to really appreciate that uniqueness, right? That green that you're talking about. And even before a lot of the upgrades that they've done to the field, there was just that feeling. It's a different feeling in that ballpark as it is when you walk into Wrigley or Old Yankee Stadium or a few locations in the game that have been around for so long. I do appreciate it more now than I think I did even back then.
So I was also, you know, somebody who read a lot. I wasn't as good as math as you ever were, but I you know, I wasn't an idiot either. And I was fascinated by statistics. I memorized statistics. I remember playing Sports Illustrated Baseball back then. It was a dice game. So it was all about probabilities and understanding situations and all that. Did you have a game like that that kind of led you down the analytics path?
You know, it's funny. Everyone probably thinks it would have been something like Strat-O-Matic baseball or otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know, I had cousins. I come from a huge family on my mom's side. I think I have 28 first cousins. So, and they're all at crazy ages, you know, all around. And so people pass down games and other baseball things. But that really wasn't, you know, my love for the game. It was playing it, being around it. And quite frankly, when I got into it, you know, my angle was more the scouting side and the evaluation side. And, you know, the analytical side is really something that just has become a part of the game that you learn. But it was the really tried and true passion for it, being around it. My uncle was a longtime high school coach and college umpire who did umpire in the Cape Cod Baseball League every summer a little bit. I would just go track with him and watch games when I was a kid. And be around those types of players. And what I loved about it was just watching the game of baseball and some of those guys that then went on to play in the big leagues.
I think one of the coolest things I've heard you say, and I think we were talking in the Twins dugout a year or two ago, you said, you know, people have this concept of analytics, meaning that all you do is look at a computer, you discard the human element, and you go by just these raw numbers. And I remember you saying something like, you know, we use analytics so you can free up people. You know, if a scout doesn't have to hold up a jugs gun or have a stopwatch in his hand every 5 minutes, then he can go do background on a player. Is that the best way to describe your approach to analytics?
Yeah, no doubt. It's really just a slice of the information pie, so to speak, when you're trying to figure out what a player is. And as you just alluded to, that's what we tell our scouts all the time. Yes, they want to evaluate the talent on the field. They're going to write their report. None of that has changed in the time of the analytical, you know, revolution, so to speak, in the game. What now you allow a scout to do is say, hey, the pitch is breaking a certain way because we have some tools that can actually assess that in a game. How do you think he, you know, can he make adjustments because his slider's got a little more, you know, horizontal movement to it, or a little more left-right movement or east-west movement? Do you think he can get a little bit more north to south? Find out how approachable he is, how coachable he is. Can he make adjustments? How much feel does he have? Because the best players in the game I've been around, you watch Kenta Maeda make an adjustment to a pitch. It's incredible feel. It's the ability to make those adjustments. We want our scouts to figure that stuff out on top of, you know, what the evaluation of the talent is as they're watching him on the field.
I also remember you telling me once that, you know, if you're spending like a typical day at the office, no night games, you're going to go home, maybe have a chance to have dinner with your family, that you would go home, spend time with your wife, your kids, make sure, you know, get everybody off to bed, and then you would go hit the computer. Is that the way your days go?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty common. I try and be as balanced as possible in a job that has, it's difficult at times to have balance. People talk about that, you know, do you turn it off when you go home or on? It's kind of woven into my life, right? You pick up the phone on Thanksgiving Eve at 11 o'clock if an agent calls. That's just the way this works. My wife is incredibly supportive, and I'm incredibly lucky as a result. But what I end up doing is spend that time with my kids, focus, and try and be present where I am. And then, you know, people start going to bed in my house, and it's my job then to try and figure out to use that additional time. So those late evenings or early mornings before they get up are good times for me to dig in a little further.
And what are you digging into at that point?
You know, it depends on the time of year, you know, or day, you know, during the season. If it's in the off season, those late nights are still probing a little more of the free agent conversations, the potential trade fits. Maybe it's something altogether different about leadership development within our group and things we're trying to do in the front office or scouts, as we were just talking about scout development. I'm constantly trying to think about ways and learn from other industries what we can apply into our space. I've seen quotes from whether it's Nick Saban or Barack Obama or others that say, you know, there's a lot of good ideas out there already. I didn't come up with it, and I don't need to be the person to have come up with it for it to be a good idea. I just want to adapt it and use it in our environment and make us better. And that's kind of the way I look at it. So I spend often, you know, late at night or early in the morning trying to read, sometimes outside of the game of baseball.
You've also talked about the collaborative approach in your organization, whether if it's pregame with Rocco, postgame with Rocco, up in the front office with you and Thad. And I mean, can you take me inside one of those meetings? How many, you talk about wanting to be open to all opinions, but there's obviously logistical limits to how many people you can listen to. What are those meetings like? How many people might you include? And how do you include them if they just don't happen to be sitting there at that moment?
Yeah, you know, over the last year, it's been really challenging at times because we're not in the same building. You know, we're using Zoom. But as we moved into this, it actually became easier using Zoom because you can invite more people and be a part of the conversation. The way I lay that out is everyone's willing, or anyone who's able within our group, whether you're an intern or a 25-year scout in our organization, you can weigh in on any of our conversations. Now, certainly people who have more expertise in a given area their opinion or their recommendation may carry a little bit more weight for me when we're talking through it. But that's the only way to develop your next generation of people that are going to be in your office, is to have them observe those conversations, watch what happens when we go back and forth with scouting personnel and Rocco and our analytics group and our pro scouting staff and people in player development. And then ultimately a decision has to get made. So my only kind of rule, so to speak, is that we are equal voice when we're discussing this, whether it's me or the intern. We all have the ability to enter information into the conversation. At the end of the day, I'm going to have to make a call, and I just expect that everyone get behind it at that point. You may disagree, but at the end of the day, let's just make sure we're going out the door all in the same direction, and our group really embraces that.
So you hired a young man who had never managed before to be your manager, and I know Rocco's strengths are obvious. Can you remember a moment during the interview process? And he told me it was a really extensive interview process where that something clicked when he said, oh, this might be our guy.
During the early portion of it, I remember kind of feeling out his level of empathy. Actually, I don't know if I've ever told anybody this part of the story, which was when we first brought him in for the first interview, my father had just had a heart attack. And I had to track back to Boston. He was okay by the time I learned about it. He was in the hospital, but they had, you know, managed everything, and everything looked like it was going to be okay going forward. But I met Rocco at the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport at a restaurant as he was coming in, and I spent about an hour and a half to 2 hours with him. And then I was going out, and he spent the rest of the time with our group. And his level of empathy, you know, in the conversation there, but us being able to talk about baseball, get a little deeper, was great. And then toward the back end of the conversation, and this was in the first round, and again, we had a subsequent round, a second round where we went a lot deeper. He was not afraid to say, I don't know, you know, and on with certain questions asked him. And I think sometimes that vulnerability is viewed as a weakness in managing or being a head coach. You can't say you don't know there, because if you say that, you know, no one will respect you or get behind you. I think that level of vulnerability is critical for leadership. And I say it in the front office, and a lot of our people do. It's okay to say, I don't know, and then lean on people that can help you get to a decision and understand a little bit more. I think that's the environment we want to create, is a group that can constantly test each other, but there's no false confidence. It's just all about how you build and you continue to learn, and you build the environment in the organization that allows everyone to continue to learn.
And you mentioned your father. Did you pick up on Rocco's empathy because of your father?
Well, I think during the course of the conversation, he wanted to talk about that as much as the baseball side. And he was right in that moment competing for a job, right? You think in an interview setting, there's a candidate who comes in who says, hey, I just want to show who I am, and I only have a certain amount of time to do that, to put myself out there. That wasn't his goal. And I just remember thinking to myself after the fact, I don't even think I felt this in the moment, but after the fact, those are the kinds of conversations you have to have with players when they're going through struggles and there's some ups and downs. It's not just about the performance on the field at that time. It's how are things going at home? How are, you know, you're talking about contracts. Some guys are weighing long-term decisions, things like that. How do you lead men through that conversation? You have to have a base level of connectability and empathy in that seat as a manager, I think, to be the best version of what you can be. And he certainly has that.
You know, Rocco's a challenge because every local sports columnist is supposed to pick on the baseball manager every day, because the baseball manager makes 800 decisions. There's always something you can second guess, right? But Rocco's such a good human being, and he's thought through all these things so well. It's like if I on the rare occasions I might nitpick something, I feel guilty.
Well, trust me, he gets that. He gets that part of the job and understands it. But he also gets us back to that previous point. You know, when I sit in my seat, Rock sits in his seat, anybody in our organization that has to make decisions, you recognize you're going to be second-guessed, and you're certainly going to have some naysayers in every decision you make. That's okay. You have to embrace that. You have to have some thick skin on that front. But you have to know that if deep down you're doing it because you believe your process, you know, your internal process, your combination of gut, the studies you've done, the work you've done to try and figure your way to a final decision, as long as you know that process is sound and that you did everything you could, you live with the outcome. Sometimes the outcomes don't work out. But I think as long as I'm going back and, you know, questioning my process, and I know Rocco thinks of this the same way, did we have a good process? Okay, we didn't have a good result. Let's make sure we learn from that experience, that one decision, that one opportunity, and keep going and growing from there.
Two or three more questions with Derek Fowley. Thanks for joining me today, Derek. I appreciate it. Do you have to have a dictionary with you when you meet with Ed Levine?
Yes, all the time. A dictionary or a thesaurus, so I can look up the word and find out, you know, some similarities I could use when I come back at him.
What's the dynamic like with Ed? Because I don't think it's too big a secret. I think Thad's probably had opportunities to go elsewhere if he wanted to. He seems to really like it here and liking working for you. What is the dynamic between the two of you?
I think it's first and foremost a friendship, you know, and that bond as we go. As you just said, you know, Thad's got incredible skills. He could, if he wanted to go lead an operation or organization, he certainly could. I think what Thad enjoys most, though, is the human connections and the people within the organization and trying to inspire people to be their best and connect with them at that base level. And I think the reason it works for us is because there are aspects of what he likes to do that he knows he'd probably have to cut off and, you know, do a little less of if he had to also be working on some of the more strategic long-term design, you know, questions at times. And so we balance that. We complement each other really well. We find ways to navigate some of the difficult challenges. But at the base level, it's a friendship, trust in one another. I lean on Thad just as I do so many others within our group when we make any major decision. And ultimately, I think we have a really good environment that allows for that.
Two more questions. The first, it's a weird question, and I'm really curious about the answer. I'm not asking you to put you on the spot or anything like that. I really want to hear what you have to say. You know, we are in this age of social justice, athletes speaking their mind, and the sports arena being used as a political arena in a lot of ways, for better or worse. Do you ever consider a player's views on social justice as part of their makeup?
Oh, that's a good question. I think what we try and do, certainly over the last year, we've had a lot of conversations with our players around what has gone on locally, of course, you know, with the murder of George Floyd, but then also so many other aspects of what has transpired across our country, across our world. And we have those conversations. But I think where I go to with that, to understand someone's makeup, so to speak, is to understand where they're coming from. You know, I seek first to understand before judging anybody. And so understanding where someone's from, what their background is, what leads them to certain decisions or otherwise, really helps you understand the person. And I think we're naive if we approach anybody and think that, you know, we know their entire background and what has led them to decisions. And I try and empathize first to understand where they're coming from and then evaluate how that person in aggregate fits into our environment and in our clubhouse and how it will work. But try and judge everyone, you know, individually and get to know them as best I can.
Last question of this interview. Again, thank you to Derek. Can you be a success in your job if you don't win the World Series? I actually have a very strong opinion about this, but I want to hear what you have to say first.
Well, I think that is our goal, right? There's no way to short that. When you get out, when you put a team together, you're trying to win it all. You're trying to win the World Series. But I view big picture, long-term success, sure, as winning at the major league level. But I want to grow an organization. I want to develop people. I want to put people in good positions to succeed. I want to lead in that way. And I want to be a partner with everybody in the environment. I want to look back on my career and feel like I've done that. I've made every person who's worked with us the best version of themselves. And if I've done that in my career, I will view my career as having been successful. Of course, we want to win a World Series on the field. There's no question in my mind. But I recognize that, you know, sometimes that doesn't happen for people along the way. And if I sure hope we have that. I sure hope I don't have to answer the question of one or the other. I'd love it to be an and. But what I think I value the most is the people part and the development part and making sure we put our people in positions to win. Because if we have a good process and a good organization, we're going to give ourselves the best chance to win that World Series. I firmly believe that.
And I know, you know, I always look back at what if Andy McPhail had lost 2 7th games instead of 1-2? You know, would he have been a failure? Would Terry Ryan, executive of the year, brought back a franchise that had offered itself up for contraction to become an annual winner? I just can't view it, everything in the prism of the championship. Championships are fickle.
Yeah, you're right. I think, you know, I've been in an organization that lost a game 7 of a World Series, yeah, just like you said. So I've been on the other side of that. I can tell you that I have the utmost respect for the people who are in Cleveland and that I worked with then and got there. We did not hoist that trophy. That will always eat at us, no question, for that year. But it doesn't mean that every person in that organization I wouldn't view as having had a successful run, even during that season, quite frankly. And as you said, sometimes it works out and you win the World Series. Sometimes it doesn't. Doesn't mean that we're trying any less hard, if I say otherwise. But I feel like you know, what you do every day and the people you impact and how you, how the culture you create and you foster, I think is what is going to ultimately define success for someone's career.
Good stuff. Thank you, Derek. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.